yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, IE 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the topic today is Bitcoin again. How could we not talk about Bitcoins and financial speculation? Because that's all it is. Bitcoins are digital tulips. What's digital tulips? What's he talking about? Well, I think I may have mentioned it before, but it's very much reminiscent of the 17th century Dutch tulip mania, where the Dutch were buying and selling tulip bulbs, not because they liked flowers, but because the price was going up. That was the only reason. The price goes up, you know, you flip it, capital gains. Someone else, thinking the price will continue to go up, buys it, and the flipping goes on, and it's a pure speculative play. Well, why did that occur in Holland in the 17th century? Well, because Holland had become a colonial power, a little country, very small. Actually, Holland is only part of the Netherlands, but, you know, we're using the same interchangeably, Holland, Netherlands. And, you know, they had cornered the spice trade in the East India and Ceylon and Indonesian islands and so forth, and elsewhere, and they had this massive amount of liquidity as a result of their imperial exploitation of the spice trade. You know, they brought it back to Europe and they sold it in other places as well. So they had a huge amount of liquidity, money, cash, and being a small country, there wasn't much they could invest in there. And being the nature of their exploitation, it wasn't as if they were multinational companies going around building things everywhere around the world like the U.S. now. No, it was just agricultural. And with all that extra liquidity, they had nowhere to go. So what did they do with it? They created financial markets. You know, the tulip bulbs were a commodity market, a financial speculation in tulip commodities. Well, Bitcoin's just like that. Bitcoin is a commodity, not yet a currency, not yet legal tender competing totally with you know, the U.S. dollar. And, you know, the government regulators are watching that closely. When it steps over that boundary and it becomes money used for exchanges, medium of exchanges for transactions, buying and selling things, well, then they will step in. But as long as, you know, Bitcoin is a commodity and speculation in it, you know, they don't have a problem with that as long as they're able to maybe have some minimal influence over regulation by establishing a clearinghouse. And that's in the process. We'll talk about that more. So Bitcoin as a commodity, as a speculative play, is very much tolerated, and that's what it is right now. And that's what's one of the things that's really driving the price, the speculative play, financial speculation, you know, buying and selling. Well, it's not unlike gold. You know, it's the same thing as gold. I mean, gold is not currency. You can't use gold to buy and sell things. Or you can accumulate it as a hedge and trade it as a security, right? A commodity. Gold is a commodity, not as a currency anymore. But commodity is tolerated. In fact, what's really tolerated is gold futures, commodity futures, where you can buy and sell options and future bets on gold. And that's very much a allowed and established for a long time. And the same with after 1999, we made oil. a commodity, not just in a physical sense, but in a security sense, oil futures trading, right? Turn these commodities into financial asset markets, and that's where you really make your money. At least the big boys do. Options trading and futures trading. Well, you know, Bitcoin's not unlike gold and oil futures. And that's, you know, one of the things that's important to understand about Bitcoin. It's not that people have a demand for Bitcoin as money in order to use it to buy things, although there's a little bit of that going on in select locales and companies and markets and stuff. But that's what's got the attention of the regulators and the central banks in particular, because if it becomes money, in the broad sense of the meaning of money, then the regulators and the central banks will step in. I mean, the central banks are having a hard time controlling the money supply now. If they allow bitcoins, digital cryptocurrencies, as they're called, to become money, well, then they're going to lose even more control of the money supply. Right now, they're able to influence the supply of what's called fiat money. In other words, currency, dollars, and stuff. But if it were Bitcoin, digital money, digital currencies, they would totally lose control. This is one of the topics that I took up in my book here, just published a few months ago, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, arguing that they were, among other things, the central banks, the Fed, and the other major central banks were long-run losing control of the money supply. You know, and that's their main tool to influence interest rates. And interest rates are losing their influence as well at a national level. So one of the arguments in my book was that, the central bank's tools that they use are not very effective anymore. And they're losing control of influencing the economy. Important development. Well, one of the reasons they're losing control is changing global financial structures around the world. They can't keep up with the changes. Fintech, financial tech, technology, of which Bitcoin digital currencies are one example, online lending and others are also examples. These are developments within the foundation of global capitalism and the global capitalist financial system that are changing, transitioning, transforming far more rapidly than government institutions can keep track and regulate and stay up with the changes. Technology drives capitalism, and the institutions can't keep up. That's a condition, very obviously, now in the 21st century. And that's one of the reasons they're at the end of their ropes. That means that they are having less and less influence and effectiveness monetary policies, and not just the Federal Reserve, but the other central banks as well. Well, that's the book, looking at technology and looking at finance, the new global finance capital elite, their new institutions, their new financial asset markets, the role of technology and communications and everything, and how they are gaming the system like they've never had before. And as a result of getting super, super rich, the new finance capital elite, their influence is growing over political systems as well. And we can see that very clearly in the U.S., where investment bankers from Goldman Sachs now run the U.S. economy. Well, I'm not going to go into that again. I've said that a couple of times on prior shows. But there's a political consequence to this as well. Right. Okay, so we're talking about bitcoins as currency. No, not yet. But they're being watched, and we're talking about bitcoins as commodity. Yeah, that's here, and they're giving the green light to Bitcoin as commodity here. Well, what's really driving Bitcoin prices in the bubble? You know, we could call this show, and I think I'll when I post it up on the PRN website for a podcast, I think I'll call this the 1500%. For them, 0.5% for us. Well, what does that refer to? Well, Bitcoin in just 1 year, just Bitcoin, there's a couple hundred cryptocurrencies out there. Just Bitcoin alone, the price has appreciated 1,500%. At the beginning of the year, it was $900 and something per coin. Well, last week it was 15,000 per coin, and it accelerating. Yesterday, on one of the exchanges, these are totally unregulated exchanges. You know, anyone sets up an exchange if they want. $19,000. You know, well, this is a bubble. No doubt, this is a bubble. You know, economists and politicians and central bankers want to argue that financial asset bubbles, we can't do anything about them. They argue, well, you can't notice when something is in a bubble. Where, at what point does the price increase become a bubble? And if we did something about it and we burst the bubble, it probably would make things worse. So the policy has to be, we just let these bubbles go and burst on their own. Well, we let the subprime mortgage bubble bust on its own, didn't it? And we know what that did. Okay, so it's a lot of BS that they can't define a bubble, and it's worse to intervene than not. The reason they don't intervene, because in these bubbles there's so much money to be made, and the central bankers don't want to incur the ire of investors when they're making a lot of money. So they stand back, you see. They're not going to kill the goose that lays the golden speculative egg for anybody out there in a financial institution community. So they stand off, and the excuse is, oh, you know, we're going to make it worse, blah, blah, blah. That's been going on since Alan Greenspan and Bernanke, too, and Yellen. They're all the same. They're not going to intervene here because they're really the handmaidens of the private banking system. You know, academics talk about central banking independence, and they often refer to, interference by politicians. Yeah, the investment bankers, Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn in the administration here, and until recently, you know, several of the Fed districts, in particular New York Fed, they're central bankers. Are there government politicians, government bureaucrats? They're not going to are they interfering? Yeah. They're from Goldman Sachs. They're part of that community. And one of the most glaring revolving doors between government and business is the Federal Reserve, the central bank. The governors go back and forth between the bankers. You know, they put in a stint of a couple years as governors of the Fed, and then they get a nice fat sinecure job in one of the banks after 2 or 3 years. You know, when their term of appointment is supposed to be 14 years, you see, to make them immune from influence from the bankers. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, sure, they're immune. Well, the problem is central bank independence from the bankers, not from the government politicians who are in the key positions, bankers anyway. Okay, so that's also covered in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, showing these revolving doors and how the central bank is supposed to be a government agency. No. The central bank is a quasi-government, quasi-private business institution that's there and created to bail out the banks whenever they get in trouble, and they get in trouble repeatedly, so that the politicians don't have to take the heat when the bailout comes. You see, they leave the bailout to this mysterious institution called the central bank that people don't understand what's going on. And yeah, it was the Fed that bailed out the banks in the last crisis to the tune of about $7 trillion in direct bailouts alone, called QE, quantitative easing, not counting other traditional means of buying and selling bonds. Yeah, $7 trillion. Well, they tell us that the balance sheet of the Fed is only $4.5 trillion. But what they don't tell you is that as some of these bailouts matured, The central bank, the Fed, just turned around and reissued further bailouts, you see, funding. So it's really $7 trillion, 6 to 7 trillion, not $4.5 trillion. And that's one of the issues in central bank now. How do they get rid of this 4.5 trillion, 7 trillion? Okay, they're not going to do it, in other words, is what I have been saying all along and said in the book. Well, that's enough talking about the central banks. Let's get back to Bitcoin here. Okay, so we're talking about Bitcoin as a commodity versus a currency, as a pure speculative financial asset market play, as really a substitute for gold. That's what it is, and maybe even oil futures. Yes, a substitute for gold. Look, speculators like volatility in prices. They like prices to run up fast and go down, and then run up again, and then go down. And in fact, what we see is this traditional way of speculators manipulate price to make it volatile. It's called pumping and dumping. We'll talk about that. And that's part of what's going on here, why Bitcoin runs up several thousands and then reverses and retreats a couple thousand, then goes up again several thousand, back and forth, back and forth. Well, it's being manipulated because you make money on futures and options, whether it goes up or down. And if it does both, they like it. Well, look at gold. Gold's not moving at all. You know, gold is stuck in this narrow band for quite some time, and speculators don't want to take a risk just for a pittance in their view of maybe a 10 or 20% gain in the price of gold. No. And besides, the problem with the price of gold is that gold is a finite commodity. There's not too much of it, but anybody can create bitcoins. Yeah, well, how are they doing that? Why do we have 200 different kinds of companies issuing their bitcoins? Well, it's based on a technology called blockchain technology. What is blockchain? Well, it's a software that fintech, financial tech companies are and have been creating. That cuts out the middleman in transactions, particularly global transactions where you have banks involved. You know, if you want to move money from one country to another, you gotta go through sometimes a series of different banks to exchange it and move it. You know, you gotta have SWIFT codes and IBAN codes and all this nonsense, where all these bankers, commercial bankers, traditional bankers, take a big cut along the way, you see. But you got to hire a lot of people, and it's a lot of cost to do that. The banks would rather reduce their cost in moving money around, especially now that the banks are global themselves. Blockchain technology allows this very convenient, let's get the middleman out of that, and everybody can go direct to anybody else in buying and selling. You know, the transactions in the global banking industry amount to $134 trillion a year. Well, you know, the fees for that and the costs for that are significant. If you can knock out those costs and so forth, companies that would have to otherwise go through banks to move their money around don't have to do it. Plus, there's another advantage of using Bitcoin to move your money around. There's no paper trail. Or very, very little paper trail. Bitcoin is a software, I mean, excuse me, blockchain is a software that allows you to have what's called a digital wallet. And people are buying and selling into your wallet, and it's supposed to be more secure. Who knows? Nothing's really secure in the digital world, but they claim it's more secure. And the advantage of blockchain is that you know, you can make more transactions faster and for less cost, right? So that's the technology underlying this, because these same software companies creating this digital wallet, blockchain, are also, as a side business, spinning off bitcoins, because Bitcoin is based on buying and selling and, you know, in the internet, opaquely, where regulators can't see and tax collectors can't go. And that's another reason why it's so popular, for just buyers and sellers. You know, it's a nice way to avoid regulations, government regulations and taxes. And then you can pump and dump it. You know, speculators can pump the price up and dump it, and which is supposed to be an illegal activity. But if you can't see it, well, then it's not illegal. But Bitcoin is, in a forthcoming article, I will put excerpts of this article up on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Go take a look at it later today. Bitcoin is really a canary in the financial asset coal mine here. It's an example of runaway pure speculation. And we get this kind of speculative financial asset movements late in the credit cycle, which means the business cycle is long in the tooth and nearing its end here. And you get this froth going on, and we can see it very clearly with Bitcoin, but it's also going on in stocks, in the stock market, where technology changes and other manipulations are really driving the U.S. and Japanese stocks quite high. But behind even that, more fundamentally, is this central bank for decades now, central bank injections of tens of trillions of dollars of liquidity. It's like the Dutch, you see, when you got all this money unused sitting around, and there's tens of trillions on the sideline of investable funds here now. When you got all this money sitting on the sideline, professional investors don't want to let it sit idle. But, you know, there's only so many real investments and real things, making things that you can invest in. You see, there's more money than there is real asset investable opportunities. So those that are holding all this real cash find outlets for it. Well, what do they do with it? Well, they create financial asset markets. That's why they created derivatives, you know, to play in the casino with their money. And Bitcoin is just another casino table. You know, I mean, you got your poker table and you got your craps table and your blackjack table, right? Well, in the financial casino, this is just a new table. That's all. And like gold, a lot of folks were playing at the gold table or taking their money out of gold and go playing at the cryptocurrency Bitcoin table now, right? The money is sloshing around because there's so much of it created fundamentally by the central banks for 3 decades. They're the ultimate culprits of all this, creating all this excess liquidity, cash, investable cash, and near cash forms of assets. We call that liquidity, see? To absorb this liquidity, you know, new kinds of financial global institutions are created. We call them shadow banks. New forms of shadow banks, and they create these new financial asset markets for derivatives and, you know, oil futures and Bitcoin and all that stuff. And they create the new financial instruments for trading it. The new finance capital elite. Well, I covered them in depth in my January 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. I think I'll probably start serializing some of the concluding chapter to that book so folks can read my theory of financial instability and why we are late in the credit cycle and approaching that. Once again, you know, we're no more than 2-3 years away from the end and a bust, and it may come earlier. You know, the cryptocurrencies may precipitate it. I'll explain how they might here shortly. But in my analysis, you got to distinguish between different causal factors, crises and cycles and so forth. You may have fundamental factors, fundamental causes. You may have enabling causes, and you may have precipitating causes. Well, this massive increase in liquidity is a fundamental cause. And I would argue that blockchain technology is also a fundamental cause underway here, not just for Bitcoin, but for all other kinds of financial assets that are appearing as well. Fintech, they call that, fintech sector, right? Online lending, peer-to-peer lending, all that stuff, enabled by technology. These are the fundamental drivers going on, but what are the enabling factors? The fundamental make it possible, drive the possibility towards reality. And when it appears, the enabling factors accelerate it, you see. And when you get to the end of the bubble, then precipitating factors bust the bubble. Right? So I distinguish between these and have been doing for some time here. And well, what about Bitcoin? Well, fundamental is technology, blockchain, and massive central bank liquidity injections for decades. Well, what are some of the enabling forces here or factors behind it? Well, when you get so many companies spinning off their own cryptocurrencies, they call these initial public offerings, or in the case of cryptos, we call those initial coin offerings. In other words, they're all raising money for their software, blockchain, and other development by issuing bitcoins. It's kind of like a de facto stock issue, totally unregulated, of course, right? And those companies are investors, high-risk investors, want to get in on the development of blockchain because that's where big money is going to be that isn't going to go away or bust. They provide real money to the startup, and they get Bitcoin in exchange, and they become players in the Bitcoin market. You know, Bitcoin starts out with the techies. The techies believing that, oh, Bitcoin is going to get rid of currency as we know it, controlled by a big bad government, and therefore it's going to democratize the world. And, kind of like all that social media BS when it all started. You know, it's a cultural, philosophical, libertarian kind of thing for many of them. Well, they were the early investors, the retail investors. But now when you start getting all these ICOs and you get other investors beginning to enter this market, it creates even more demand for the Bitcoin. You see, prices are a function of supply and demand. In the case of financial assets, it's mostly a function of demand. Demand really outweighs supply factors by huge amounts. The prices aren't regulated by supply. It's just demand, and the prices go up. Even more demand comes in, drives the prices up even more, and more people come in who weren't around or forgot what the prior crash was all about. New generation, and they're just greedy, and they think they can out-time the market. They think that they can get out before the price goes bust. You know, this is what speculators are all about. They think they're smarter than the rest of the herd mentality and the rest of the herd investors. You see, but it turns out they almost never are. Maybe just a few who get out early, because when the price bust crash comes, it comes very fast. You know, we see how fast Bitcoin is going up. Well, believe me, when it busts, it'll come down even faster. And you won't be able to sell your Bitcoin because everyone's going to be trying to be selling and no one wants to buy. And you're just going to ride that monster crash and burn into the ground. Right? And that's what's going to happen to a lot of them. But they think they're smarter and they can outsmart the market. And they'll get away making a lot of money. Well, history shows all those tulip buyers made a big mistake. And in fact, that whole tulip mania, when it went bust in Holland, ruined the Dutch economy for almost a generation. And with the economy crashing, Holland couldn't compete with Britain and got pushed aside in the colonial race, particularly in the new world. You know, they had to, quote, sell a New Amsterdam, New York to the British as a solution because their economy had collapsed and they couldn't build ships fast enough to compete with ships created by the British. And So there's a political imperial consequence of these markets crashing as well. Well, the market's going to crash here for Bitcoin, but not right now, not in the foreseeable near future meaning next few months. It eventually will, but it's not about to do so. It'll go higher. It'll go higher. Well, again, because all of it is driven by demand. Demand drives the market in these financial speculative assets and speculative plays. And global capitalism is becoming more and more enamored and involved with these financial asset speculation because it's far more profitable, you see. I talked about that in my Systemic Fragility book as part of what's called the financial asset shift. In other words, more and more money capital is flowing into financial assets because of the central bank creating all the extra money. But it's also sucking out money from real investment that otherwise might have occurred because it's so much more profitable. Professional investors don't care how they make their money. They just want to make it fast and as safe as they can. Well, that's one of the reasons why we have this long-run trend of declining real asset investment, you know, what we call capital goods and so forth in the U.S. GDP, right? That's slowing decline, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And, of course, that leads to slower productivity growth, and that leads to cutting wages and so forth and not giving wage increases to workers. Well, those things are happening too. Productivity is declining, real investments are declining, wages are stagnant or declining for the bottom 80%. But why is that occurring? Well, economists can't answer it. I think it has to do with sucking out the money capital from real investment into financial markets, financial investment, because it's much more profitable to invest, even though the greater risk. Okay, so think of the bubble in Bitcoin as primarily the product of escalating demand for Bitcoin. You know, it was like the tulip bulbs. The more the demand, the more the price went up, the more the price went up, the more the demand ran in. And we're seeing that occurring here as well, as all of these different players start spinning off their own version of Bitcoin on their version of blockchain that they're trying to create. And as you know, the ICOs are floated, the price goes up because the price is going up for Bitcoin. So the price goes up for these new players, and because the new ones are going up, Bitcoin goes up too. So they feed off of each other. See, the more ICOs we get, the more pressure on demand, and the more that cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin escalate in price. Some of the cryptos like Bitcoin, Ethereum, become what we call blue chip, and more of the money flows into them than into what might be the small cap cryptos that are proliferating everywhere. So we've moved beyond the retail buyers and those who were just running into buying Bitcoin and other because it was a fashion. And, you know, you can recall the fashion in 1992-100. Anything that had an E, any company that was floating an initial offering that had an E before it for e-commerce or a .com after it, you know, investors were just indiscriminately investing in this stuff. And I know some of these companies was around at the time in business circles, and people were just blindly investing in these companies that hadn't made a penny, you know, but they were plowing their money in. Well, that's a bubble. That's a mania. And, of course, we call that the dot-com bubble. Well, you know, we got the bubble reemerging here. And it's not subprime mortgages. No, that's been tamed. But the bubbles keep popping up. It's kind of like whack-a-mole, you know. The regulators whack one out and it pops up somewhere else. Well, we got a new mole emerging, several of them, that they're going to have to whack, right? So we're beyond the techie cultural fashionable investing, and now we're moving into real investment in Bitcoin in particular, the prime blue chip. A lot of investment going in there, driving up the price. Well, why? Well, because they know as a speculative play, as I said, there's no regulation. They can do their manipulating games, pumping and dumping, get away with it, right? No regulation. It's opaque. And even more so, it's non-taxable. If you can't see the transactions going on, Mr. Government Regulator, you can't tax it. That's why the government's play right now is to try to move it into traditional established clearinghouses where it will be less opaque how much money is being made and therefore how much it can be taxed, you see. But right now it's still not regulated or taxed. But you got to create the clearinghouse institution before you can really regulate it and especially tax it, right? And that's coming, you see. And that's why the price has gone up, what, 50% in 1 or 2 months here for Bitcoin? Because the clearinghouse is coming. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the CBOE Exchange, these are real long-term established commodity exchanges, are going to start listing Bitcoin and maybe other cryptocurrencies where people can buy and trade them. Well, knowing that development is around the corner and will occur this month, officially announced, well, they know that there's going to be even more demand for Bitcoin. So that drives the price up and brings more people in the market to get in before that price goes up even further. And that drives the price up too in the process, you see. So we got a process of legitimation of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies going on here by the business banking government communities. And investors know that. It's not just the technology driving it anymore. It's not just the early market entrance here, the techies and so forth, right? We got public offerings going on that they make money off of. But now it's legitimizing it and making it a commodity in the official sense that can be bought and sold. Now, this is where the big capitalist speculators come in, because what's going to happen once they start trading it on an exchange, a legit exchange, what's going to happen is they're going to create futures and options off of it and derivatives off of it. You're going to see an exchange traded fund, an ETF for cryptos. Yeah. Well, what are these? These are derivatives. These are derivatives. Options, futures, ETFs, and so forth, right? This is the new subprime mortgage play, right? And it's going to be just as disruptive eventually. And I'm not even going to talk about ETFs and passive index trading driving the stock market or the bond markets. That's another form of derivatives. ETFs are the new subprime mortgages. I'm not even going to talk about that here today. That's another topic. But, you will see ETFs for cryptos, on the CME and CBOE exchanges. Well, the big boys know that. And the hedge funds are poised to jump in and start buying and selling stuff. Well, even the big traditional banks, Goldman Sachs legitimizes Bitcoin further by saying they're going to participate in this. And even commercial banks, like J.P. Morgan Chase and a few others have said, Bitcoin is a fraud. Well, it is. But then out of the other side of the mouth, they say, well, we're going to facilitate the trading. We're not going to invest in it ourselves. We'll let the other suckers take the risk. But we're going to charge fees. Hmm? So that legitimizes it even more. And then you get Japan and some other countries saying, oh, we want to be the center of these crypto exchanges. And certain governments legitimize it. Other governments don't. Like Mexico's come out against it and a few others there. Well, why are they against it? Because they know it's going to wreck their currency and that they're going to lose control of their money supply, which is very tenuous in some of these countries anyway. So, you know, the bureaucrats are worried about that. And so you get this mixed bag here of some countries for it and some against it. But, you know, that home of the big speculation, Japan, is all for it. You know, Japan was the first one in the 80s to engage in this runaway financial asset speculation, which led to the collapse in 1991 and the lost decade, as they say, for Japan. And Japan has had a problem ever since, relying, as it does, on financial assets. And the central bank, by the way, in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, is propping up all these financial asset markets directly. The Bank of Japan is not only buying bonds, government bonds, and corporate bonds, driving up the price, because once again, if you go get the government moving in, demand drives up the price. But it's buying stocks and other derivatives in Japan. You know, if it wasn't the Bank of Japan pumping $6 trillion into a much smaller economy than ours, Japan would be in a depression. It would have collapsed financially. The central bank is keeping it afloat. And in fact, all the central banks are subsidizing capitalism in the 21st century, increasingly with their programs of buying up securities and making sure interest rates are down there on the floor for 8 years. You know, that's a form of subsidization of the profits of these companies. Right. So capitalism 21st century is required, or even if it's not required, it's moving towards having the state institutions subsidize it more and more. In some cases, the subsidizing keeps the businesses from collapsing altogether. In other cases, it allows companies that weren't collapsing to make even more money than they were. Okay, so that's what the central bank does, you know, primarily now. It's a force of subsidization. Well, you could say they've pushed that subsidization as far as they can, and they're helping create all these bubbles we're talking about with all this excess liquidity. So now they're sort of saying we can't go any further, the central banks are saying. We're creating worse conditions than in the process of subsidizing. So now you see governments, particularly led by Trump in the U.S., saying, okay, we got to have a new form of business subsidization. Well, not so new. It's called tax cuts for corporations and businesses, non-corporate businesses and banks and investors, right? Well, we've been talking about that, and I'm sure next week we'll have a chance to talk about the new joint House Senate tax bill and what's in it. You know, they're right now, they're sort of reconciling a few of their differences, but it's going to be a $4 to $5 trillion business investor tax cut. They say, oh, it's $1.5 trillion. No, $1.5 trillion is what's left over that they have to cut the budget, social spending. They're going after Medicare and Social Security and food stamps and what they say welfare next to make up that $1.5 trillion loss. That's the deficit from this bill. But the real amount of tax cuts for business and so forth is $4.5 trillion. And they're making up $3 trillion by raising taxes on the middle class. So $4.5 trillion minus $3 trillion, $1.5 trillion yet to do something about. And that's where the attack is going to come here. Paul Ryan in the House, you know, that butcher, economic butcher, you know, would sell his grandma for a buck. He's leading the charge as he always has. Just doesn't like Social Security, you see, or Medicare. These are bad programs. Yeah, 58 million people are supported with total medical coverage with Medicare at a cost of 1.45%. tax, you know, while the employer pays 1.45, so 2.9% tax covers cradle to grave for 58 million retirees. You know, I mean, Can't we get it through our head that the solution is Medicare for all? It's so much cheaper. Anyway, don't get me going on that one. Back to Bitcoin. And the enabling factors driving Bitcoin prices and bubbles. The fundamental being technology and central banks, right? But the enabling, just to sum up to this point, all these ICOs and investors jumping in, and the absence of regulation and absence of taxation, right? That drives it up. Gold, the money that was investing in gold futures and options, and maybe even oil, flows out of that to the new gold. Bitcoin's better than gold, right? More gold than gold itself, right? And none of this yet is requires Bitcoin to be a currency. It's just Bitcoin, the commodity and speculative commodity markets and speculating in commodity demand, right? And that's what we've got here with Bitcoin. And now we got legitimation of the market, with the clearinghouse idea, the hedge funds jumping in, and the regular banks jumping in, albeit cautiously, right? They're jumping in too. And government regulation, I predict, will not occur until it looks like Bitcoin is trying to become a currency. Then it will occur. And we got all these big bankers like Jamie Dimon calling it a fraud, and yet they turn around and say we'll support the market indirectly. But the fact that it's going to be traded on an exchange, an official exchange, has been a big boost to demand for Bitcoin. And that's probably, once it became obvious late last summer that this is going to happen, that's probably the big factor behind the 40% run up in Bitcoin prices just in the last month or two, right? Okay. Another topic related to Bitcoin that we have to talk about here is the possibility of contagion. Contagion. What do we mean by that? Well, we saw contagion occur in the 2008-9 crash, right? When the subprime market mortgage bonds collapsed. Well, it spilled over to other financial assets and securities, and they began to collapse, and the losses were so great from all these multiple asset price deflations going on that the banks were in big trouble themselves. They couldn't cover all the losses, right? Here's a concrete example. Remember Lehman Brothers, and some of those other shadow banks and real banks, commercial banks that had invested in subprimes, like Bank America and Citigroup, almost went bankrupt. Well, they were technically bankrupt for years. They just wouldn't let them admit it. They bought into all this subprime mortgage market hype and price escalation. And as a result of all that, when mortgage companies like Countrywide and so forth collapsed, well, it dragged down the B of A. Why? Because B of A would loan money to Countrywide, actually bought it eventually. All these banks and shadow banks were loaning money to these mortgage banks, and the shadow banks, investment banks, were like Lehman and Bear Stearns, were borrowing from the commercial banks like JP Morgan, Chase, in order to lend to the speculators, you see. So they all got linked together. They all got linked together. And when the one went down, it dragged down the others. Well, that's exactly what happened with Lehman Brothers, right? Well, the derivative financial securities written by the huge insurance companies, the shadow banks, AIG, right? When Lehman went down, well, AIG went down too. Well, it didn't go down. The government pumped hundreds of billions of dollars into AIG and began managing it for a short period of time, and then when it got back on its feet, it just sort of spins them off again. That's what they mean by capitalist nationalization. You know, you buy up the bad, put the money or the bad assets in what's called a bad bank or in the treasury or someplace, and then when the assets recover 5 to 10 years later, you sell them at a discount back to the capitalist bankers. You see, that's you take the losses and you don't take the profits. Okay, so the tie-in, the contagion, was very clear between the different financial markets, subprimes being the primary, but connected through this network to all these other financial markets as well, and they were dragged down. Derivatives and so forth, various kinds. Well, we got the same thing going on in Bitcoin. Yes, we got all the investors, traditional investors now beginning to enter it. And when we get the clearinghouse, we'll get even more investment going into it. And there's a question of what will be the channels of contagion, potentially, that might occur here with Bitcoin. Right now, you know, Bitcoin's maybe $500 billion net capitalized market, you know, kind of dwarfs compared to the $55 trillion global equity markets and $74 trillion global bond markets. It's kind of small. But the size doesn't matter, you see. What matters is the psychology of investors. And if they see an important bubble like this and it collapses, well, psychologically, they made a lot of money elsewhere. You know, they're just looking for excuses, take the money and run, you see. And that's how psychologically it can spill over to other financial asset markets, also in near or bubble territory, like U.S. stocks, you know, Japanese stocks, junk bond markets globally, dollarized emerging markets, economy debt, dollarized debt. You know, bond debt of various kinds, leverage loans, and banking loans that are becoming more and more fragile, even though there's maybe $10 trillion globally of non-performing bank loans. In other words, companies that are borrowed from banks that are zombie companies can't pay the principal and interest on the loans, right? They call those loans non-performing. And there's about 10 trillion of that, of non-performing bank loans, a lot of it in Asia and Europe. They got risk-taking on loans going on increasingly now as well, on top of that base of bad loans. So, you know, the red flags are all over the global economy and the financial economy, and bitcoins may be the most obvious, but when you have this high level of fragility, as I talk about in my book, and these bubbles have gone fairly far, the savvy investors are looking for an excuse to take their money and run. Well, a Bitcoin crypto burst or bust to the market might psychologically convince some of them now's the time to move. And when the rest of the investors see some of these big-time investors move and get out of these markets, they follow, and now you got a bust in other markets as well. But more likely will be the contagion through these clearinghouses. You know, if the CME-CBOE are taking on Bitcoin cryptocurrency trading and it becomes fairly large in their basket of commodity trading, and then it collapses, well, these clearinghouses may not have the liquidity to cover the collapse. And that will have an impact on the other commodities. And, you know, if those other commodities follow in suit, it'll look like we got a commodity rout. And that will affect stocks and equities and bonds and other areas as well. So it's kind of risky for the CME and others to take on these huge highly volatile, speculative new commodities. They might get away with it, but you know, it could potentially crash the commodity trading exchanges, and that would set off a chain effect, you see. Okay, so that's a very much a channel. Another channel is that they will certainly create ETFs, exchange traded funds, based on cryptocurrencies. And these are little hand grenades, these ETFs in the financial markets everywhere. And they're the hot commodity, investment commodity right now in stocks, investors buying into ETFs, which is kind of like a fund, based upon other securities. Well, the problem with ETFs is that when the prices start contracting, you're going to have a problem selling ETFs, and there will be a panic, and that will drive down the rest of the market. Index, passive investing in stocks, ETFs plus index and passive investing is a formula for a crisis in the bubbles that are growing in the stock market. Okay. So to sum up, the contagion, I think, is very possible through the clearinghouses, through the psychology effects involving ETFs and non-ETFs, and other problem for unforeseen channels as well. It's a global economy, and all these new financial asset markets are connected by the same investors, you see. It's the new finance capital elite globally that has the huge amount of money, investable funds at its disposal that it's accumulated, and it moves the money around globally because you can technologically now and instantaneously cash out and move into something else. And it's these vast movements of money capital that destabilize these financial securities and their markets from time to time. That's the, what I meant before when I said the new financial structure, global financial structure of capitalism in the 21st century is different. And the regulators and central bankers are totally incapable of controlling it. And it's getting further and further out of their control. That's why they're on the ropes for various reasons. But you see, that's where we're going with all this financial speculation. It's a Bitcoin as the canary in the financial asset coal mine is the indicator, right? By itself, right now, $500 trillion is not as large as traditional markets. But it doesn't matter what the quantity is. It's the psychological effects of a massive deflation in asset prices on other financial markets and assets, because it's the same people who are investing in all of these things. It's not me and you. And that's why we got the Bitcoin 1500% and 0.5% for wages. I'll finish up with reference to the Bureau of Labor Statistics job data this morning, which showed, we got the 200 some odd jobs created again. Well, I believe a lot of these jobs are businesses converting a full-time worker to a couple part-time workers, and it looks as if you're boosting the labor force as a result of that. A lot of that going on that's not being picked up. Okay, so I think the 0.5%, if you adjust for inflation, 2.5% nominal wages here year over year, 0.5% of that is what is real wages, what's left. And I guess what it means is we got 0.5% and they got.